From KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com, this is The Treatment.
Welcome to The Treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell. I'm in New York, sitting across from a man you may have come to know as JD, but you should know him from Manhattan Murder Mystery, even. We go a little ways back. My guest is Zach Braff. 10 years ago this year, his first film as director and writer played the Sundance Film Festival. The film was Garden State. His newest film is Wish I Was Here. Forgive my English.
No, actually, you were about to say it the grammatically correct way, and I've heard plenty of people tell me that it is grammatically incorrect.
I would never tell you that, but I would not disagree with that. Where does the title come from?
Well, it was a play. My brother, I wrote the script with my brother Adam, and it was a play off those postcards, Wish You Were Here.
Yeah.
And then the idea in the film was someone struggling to find their own spirituality and searching for a way to be in the present moment, ultimately realizing that maybe his religion, if he had anything, was the desire and struggle to live in the present moment, be here now, as the book says. That's where we got it from. It was like, I wish I was here. I wish I was present in my life and present, not worried about the past, not obsessed about the future, but here now.
But it leads me to a question. I assume it's a question you've been asked a lot. When you saw The Graduate, because in terms of characters with a kind of a spiritual void and looking, trying to figure out where they stand in the world, and the way music is used in that film as well, it seems The Graduate must be an obvious influence on it.
The Graduate was a big influence, and I would also say Harold and Maude was a big influence. Harold and Maude was the first film I saw that was about loneliness and searching for oneself, but in a quirky, funny way.
Also somebody trying to be in the moment, and that moment's sort of eluding him.
Of course, and in a way it found a way to be so interesting and funny, but heartbreaking at the same time. And Woody Allen, of course, is another hero of mine who does that magnificently well. And so those were, I guess, my two biggest touchstones.
But I just found myself thinking about The Graduate so much, just in watching Garden State again to get ready for this, and just sort of thinking how the way music shapes the way the characters, the music basically almost plays as sort of thought balloons, or at least emotional touchstones for the character.
I like the way you said that. Yeah, I feel like if you can find the right song, that it's almost like it pulls the color out, like saturating the color on a photograph. If you find the right song for the moment, and my editor and I have this inside joke where, you know, we'll try 100 songs, and then when it happens, we point to the hair on our arms and go, oh, look, that's a strong candidate, because the right song with the right imagery gives you goosebumps. And that's what we're like in search of goosebumps as we go and try and find the right songs for the right moment.
But that musical sort of a presence of those Simon and Garfunkel songs, and how they're all in some respect melancholy. There's a touch of melancholy in each of the songs in both of the movies. And
Yeah. That's
clearly something that you want to try to communicate for these characters, isn't it?
Well, I think ultimately it's, I mean, I think loneliness and isolation are a theme. And I feel that in my own existence. And you can't write about it in too melancholy a way, because who the hell wants to see that movie? So if you find a way to tell it in a hopeful way and with some humor and with some fun quirk, if you will, it lightens it and makes it palatable. But it's definitely a theme that I want to write about, because it's true for me.
But also, too, I think the music means so much to you, because you use silence so often in your films.
Yeah, I love that you said that, because I really find that the overuse of score, and people find it funny that I say this, because my two films now are known for soundtracks, but I have a pet peeve of the overuse of music.
Really?
Yeah, because I feel like, you know, if you watch TV, TV does it worse than film, but there's so much music telling you how to feel, so much constant score, that it dissipates any feeling or emotion to it. It's like in Garden State, for example, in an analogous way, we tried to keep the camera very, very still. So when you have a giant crane move, you really feel it, because the audience, you're setting up a new language where the audience, you're sort of recalibrating their sensitivity to the camera movement. So that's what I really strategically tried to do in Garden State. And musically, the same thing. There's plenty of music in both films, but we try and very rarely have score come into the scenes. There's times it ends the scenes, or it comes in to link to the next scene. But very rarely in either film is it ever under dialogue for the bulk of the scene.
It's funny, though, because I guess I was noticing in Wish I Was Here that the camera's always moving on a cut, or very often when there's an edit, there's a move. I just thought that was an interesting sort of visual language you've always set up for yourself. And I just wonder, because these movies can, you don't want them to feel like they're so heavy. If you're this sense of movement when you're doing a cut, especially in this one, then it really sort of does move the audience along.
Yeah, I don't know. It's just all about trying to keep the story moving. And in this film, because there is a lot of drama and there is a lot of comedy, we had to find elegant ways to make those transitions. You know, on Scrubs, Bill Lawrence, the showrunner, was so genius at doing these hairpin turns from comedy, really broad comedy, to drama. And there'd be times when you'd be reading the script, like, is he going to pull this off? Or if I was directing, are we going to pull this off? Like, that's pretty steep. That's a pretty hairpin turn from comedy to drama. And he always managed to do it. And so I learned a lot from that, that the audience is smart and can handle that. I mean, we do some pretty, as you know, some pretty big turns from comedy to drama in this movie.
It's funny because, as you mentioned, Scrubs, one of the things that Scrubs really did, as you can see that shift in the first season, it went from being really broad to really serious. And the films almost start off with a kind of a broad comedy in both cases.
Yeah.
And turned serious from that.
Well, and then but yes, they do.
But I just thought that was something you wanted to do. Just sort of.
I think you can do it. I mean, the greatest writer of all time, Shakespeare, does it. Romeo and Juliet starts as a comedy. Romeo and Juliet, I did Romeo in Connecticut Regional Theater, and the director geniusly had timed it. It was outdoors, so that the sun, where we put our intermission, the whole first act was in, what was our first act, was in the daylight, and then the sun set, and the second act was at night, and the second act is a tragedy. So if the greatest writer of all time was doing it back in the 1700s, late 17th century, I guess Bill Lawrence was doing it on TV in a silly way. I think that it's doable. I think audiences don't mind it. There's so many rules in Hollywood, like, what are you? You're a comedy, you're a drama. If you're going to be a family movie, you can't have elements of fantasy and the surreal. I mean, these unwritten rules. And so my brother and I just tried to just throw all that out the window and say, well, let's just tell a good story.
It's the treatment. We're searching for goosebumps with Zach Braff, whose newest film is writer, co-writer, director, and star is Wish I Was Here. I guess I just thought, though, in those movies, it's a way of sort of giving the movie, what is kind of a small movie, kind of a larger scale at the very outset. And I just wondered if that was a conscious thing for you.
Yes, and also catching an audience's eye. I mean, I want to be pulled in right away. You know, it's in the world of musical theater, which I'm doing right now. You have the curtain goes up and you do a big ass number to make sure everyone becomes present. Right, everyone's adjusting their seats and still taking off their coats. And I know when I go to the movies, you know, someone's fiddling with their popcorn and still turning off their phone, and you just want to. I guess in the spirit of having a theatrical background, you want to grab them. So Garden State starts with this elaborate plane crash nightmare. And this starts with this big fantasy sequence.
It's interesting because both these films are about mourning. And I don't want to give too much away in terms of Wish I Was Here, but there is one of the plot terms deals with a big family crisis. And the idea of loss is kind of key in both of these films.
Yeah, I think it's just my own fear of death, and both that of my loved ones, my parents, who I have not lost, thank God, but I'm my own fear about that. And just my own existential questions about what happens to us and not believing in an afterlife. And so in my mind, this is it. And how does a secular man find spirituality? And when he's called upon to explain something to his young children, if he doesn't believe in the Old or New Testament or whatever organized religion he was presented as when he was a child, what do you teach your kids and what do you believe? This is, you know, Kate Hudson's character turns to mine one day and she goes, I thought we'd have more time to figure out what we believed. And now I have these little faces looking at me and I don't know what we're doing. And that's how I felt. And that's what my brother, who has two young children, felt. And so that's what we wanted to write about.
I just find it fascinating, too, that in both these movies, it's your daughter in Wish I Was Here and it's Natalie Portman in Garden State, these women who feel too deeply.
Hmm. I think in both films there's a couple of overlapping themes and it's probably being rescued by a great woman is one of them. I think in one way with Natalie I was writing sort of like my dream girl that would come save and rescue me, and with Joey and Kate it was the women I dreamed were in my life, the daughter I wish I'd have, who was sensitive and questioning everything and passionate about her beliefs. You know, Joey's character represents the person in the film who does have faith, who traditional religious faith is working for. And so in the beginning of the film, my character is sort of dismissive and condescending about that. But in the end, he learns to respect her because he loves her so much.
But I just find, too, that idea of somebody who – there are these sort of poles of these characters that you have, these guys who are, in some respect, floating, who are looking to something to anchor themselves to or be moored to, and these women who are just so earthbound, you know? I mean, so these almost two opposing forces, you know, of wind and earth, you know what I mean?
Yeah, I love that you say that. In fact, the elements themselves are important. Water is very crucial in both films.
Yeah.
And going back to the land. In Garden State, it was going to searching in this quarry, whereas here there's a big trip to the desert. There's a lot of water motifs in both films. Both films have someone who doesn't know how to swim. I learned how to swim late, so I'm sorry. I'm sorry. It may end up in every movie I ever make.
But that idea of somebody just sort of putting their hands in the earth or just touching, I mean, that sort of grounding oneself.
Because that's my, you know, when you don't believe in a higher power per se, what my spirituality is finding some way of dealing with the, I don't know how to say it without saying the curse, so I'll just say the mind F of living on a spinning rock in the middle of infinity. What my spirituality is the science of it all, just the earth, the elements, the fact that we're evolved from cells and looking into nature. You know, I see God in little things. I mean, it's. I felt cheesy saying this, but it is the truth. I look in an orchid and I go, okay, I see. That's my higher power. I see that. That makes sense to me. You go online and see some bizarre looking animal that lives a zillion miles under the sea, and you go, okay, I see some higher power in that. So I feel like the characters are searching for their spirituality in what they can touch tactily.
Yeah, that sort of sense of needing something to touch. And I just sort of think that scene early on where the rabbi gives your character a plant. I mean, just something like that. I mean, they're looking for something to get their hands around, aren't they, these guys?
Yes, that's great. That's a great way of putting it. Yeah, they're looking for something that they can touch because what they've been told, you know, I grew up very religious and in Judaism, and it wasn't tactile or anything you could see. It was all stories handed down, and they were wonderful allegories, but they didn't feel real or believable. They felt like wonderful allegories. They didn't feel like, okay, but that doesn't feel like it's going to help me cope with existence.
It's interesting because I just find these women and your wife and your daughter in this movie, and going back to Natalie Portman in Garden State, have a belief in love in a way the men don't.
Or that the men need to be awakened to. I think men do have it. It's funny, even with emotion, it's a funny thing. You know, people have reported getting emotional at the end of this movie. And it's funny, I watch men covertly have to hide that a tear is coming down their face. And I'm a super emotional guy, so I'm not that guy. But it's interesting watching men in a theater have to pretend like, you know, there's something itchy on their cheek. And it speaks to what you're saying about being in touch with their emotions. I think that the men are traditionally reared in our country, at least, I don't know about other countries, that emotion is for women and feminine. And so the women in both films, I think, are there to help the man get better in touch with his emotional self.
Wow, we have to take a break. I'm going to brush something off my cheek. It's the treatment. My guest is Zach Braff. His new film is director, writer, and star. It's Wish I Was Here. There's more to come. Stay with us.
You're listening to The Treatment with Elvis Mitchell from the studios of KCRW Santa Monica.
If you love discovering new music, check out the KCRW Music Mine. It's KCRW's first iPad app, dedicated entirely to music exploration. The Music Mine takes you into a galaxy of audio, video, and photos of artists from the KCRW playlists, with rolling updates so you can uncover what's next and keep up with the artists you love. Discover, listen, share in the Music Mine, KCRW's free iPad app. More info at kcrw.com.
Welcome back. My cheeks are dry. It's The Treatment. My guest is Zach Braff. His newest film is writer, director, and star is Wish I Was Here. But again, I first saw you and I rewatched the movie Manhattan Murder Mystery, which as you were telling me, Woody Allen brought you into the union.
Woody Allen got me my union card, yeah. And actually, George C. Wolfe got me my equity card. So two of my heroes brought me into the important unions. I played his son in Manhattan Murder Mystery, and my scene partners were Woody Allen, Diane Keaton, and Angelica Houston.
You're fidgeting just talking about this.
I was so nervous. If you ever go back and watch the scene...
Which I did.
I'm 18 years old. It was a one-er. I was back in the phase where Woody was doing everything like handheld one-ers.
Explain for the audience what a one-er is.
Oh, so the camera never cuts. It's
not a very long take.
Not a traditional scene where it's cut into lots of different shots. It's a lot of Manhattan Murder Mystery was a handheld camera on someone's shoulder and just really long takes where the camera just followed everyone.
And she basically shoots sort of these side scenes as if they were masters. Basically, that's the way he treats
them. Yeah, a very long master and then no coverage, which is incredibly courageous. But he's Woody Allen, so he can do that. And they were so very well choreographed. And there's so much improvising going on because he and Diane Keaton had such, as you can imagine, a relaxed way of bantering with one another that he said to me, you know, we're probably not going to say what's, you know, on the page. So just try to keep up. Meanwhile, I'm 18. I can't believe I'm there. And I'm like, keep up. I memorized like the punctuation mark of my lines. Like this is a semicolon, not a comma. And so if you watch the scene, it's kind of funny because I look like a terrified 18-year-old who's
just... You look like you're in the starting blocks, really, is what it looks like.
I look like a wide-eyed person who can't believe he's in this scene with these people. And I'm just trying to fit in my lines where I think they're supposed to go because they weren't saying any of the lines in the script.
And now you're starring in Bullets Over Broadway, the musical.
Yeah, and now I had this fun experience this many years later, 21 years later, getting to work with him, you know, for a long time and getting lots of one-on-one time with him. And he came to every single preview of the show and tweaked jokes. And it was really very, very surreal.
But people tend to be, and you probably know this as well from your own love of Woody Allen, very proprietary about Woody Allen movies. They feel like that they own them in a way. And the idea of sort of offering them a different experience of something that they know and love must be a little daunting.
Well, a couple things. It was Susan Stroman, the Broadway director's interpretation of his film. So, I mean, Woody was there and he wrote the book and he was working on the jokes and everything. But this is a big, brassy, old school musical with a 20-piece orchestra and a giant dance line of dancers.
And people falling asleep in the theater.
And you heard that story.
Yeah, I did. Yeah.
I did have someone fall asleep in the front row. She must have been 900 years old. I sent her a Red Bull at intermission. It's hard, you know. It's hard to do the show 8 shows a week. It's a lot of work. I have some Broadway friends, you know, Sutton Foster and Idina Menzel are friends of mine, and they had said, "Just you wait." And Josh Gad, who's in my film,
yeah,
and they said, "Just you wait." And I was like, "What do you mean? I can do this?" And they're like, "Musical, 8 shows a week, ain't no joke." And it ain't no joke.
What was it like after you got through the first 2 weeks of it? Because friends of mine were telling me that's when you feel like, I don't know if I can do this again. We're going up for that Tuesday show after you had that Monday
off.
Well,
what's bizarre is that they, and Bryan Cranston, who's been doing it for a while too, said to me, I ran into him at all these Tony things, and he went, it's just those Tuesdays.
Yeah, because exactly. Tuesday, you come back after that Monday off, that Tuesday.
Well, and the Tuesday house is usually traditionally the lightest house because Tuesday's not a big night for theater, and they do them at 7 because we want to offer a 7 o'clock show to people, so... It's usually your quietest house, and that's, you know, the Tuesdays at 7s are challenging. I just love that there I was with Bryan Cranston, and he's like, it's just those Tuesdays.
My guest who's offering us a new definition of Breaking Bad is Zach Braff, who's starring in Bullets Over Broadway, the musical on Broadway, but he's also in the film Wish I Was Here. I think I just feel like, though, the way you use color as a filmmaker is really kind of key, because, you know, by the time the blues show up in the film is really sort of calmed down. Mm. And I just wonder, in visual terms, because you've worked with Lawrence Sher now a couple of times,
yeah,
and he's now gone on to be a comedy director.
Yeah, that I'm so sad. I'm so happy / sad for Lawrence Sher's success. He is so talented, and he shot both my movies.
And he's from New Jersey.
He's a Jersey boy, and I adore him as a human being. And so I root for him because he's so talented, he's now going to be directing. But man, is he a great DP, because he can not only, we have the same taste and we just love this wide aspect ratio and we just love the same composition, and he shoots so fast. I mean, I shot this movie in 26 days. He's just so gifted. And in Garden State, we shot in 25 days. So to get that look in that crazy amount of time is two levels of talent. It's, wow, you're an amazing photographer and you can do it that quickly.
But I guess I just find myself sort of struck by the way you've worked these films out in visual terms, because I don't think that's what people would expect from you as a director. And I would just, again, we go back to the first 10 minutes with Garden State with those compositions, with that great shot of you with a shirt that matches the background. And it's,
I love that stuff. I mean, I love Jean-Pierre Jeunet. I love Terry Gilliam. I mean, I was really affected by production design in film school. It was something that really blew me away. And I always thought, oh, but it's always in these super stylized movies. Why can't, it's rare that you see someone, I know, and Wes Anderson obviously does it on a major way in his style. But for me, I wanted to do both films be fully based in reality, but have those little moments of production design style and little moments where you dip your toe into the surreal, whether it be a diploma on the ceiling in Garden State or, you know, I don't want to ruin anything, but a trippy scene with contact lenses in a jar in this movie.
Which is a great shot, by the way.
Thank you. That was the very last thing we photographed. The very last thing we filmed at all. My producers were screaming at me about the overtime we were into, and I was like, trust me, this shot is going to be worth it. And it was.
But getting back touching on the autobiographical, is something that your character says in the movie, when you're talking to a rabbi, is something that you said in real life, that you were kosher until you learned the glory of the cheeseburger.
Well, my father was very religious, and I had my bar mitzvah, which in the Jewish faith means that you're becoming a man. And so I went to him and I said, well, if I'm now a man, I would like to have a bacon double cheeseburger. And I watched his head explode. It was like I saw steam coming out of his ears as though I had all the gears were clanking against each other. And to his credit, he was like, okay, outside of the house. And so I wrote that into the film because there was a lot of true moments in the film, and that was one of them.
But these, and I hesitate to sort of try to isolate these as genres, but I call them really emotional comedies because they're very emotional.
Yeah, the word dramedy is horrible. I hate it for some reason, but that's what people call them.
Yeah, but because there is much, in fact, more comedy than anything else, but they have these big emotional moments in them.
Yeah.
And that particular piece of landscape, that real estate, is something you really like to work, isn't it?
You know, I have this memory of going to my grandmother's funeral, and we're in the car, everyone, and everyone's crying and kind of cuddling each other. And then someone made a joke that was hysterical and something my grandma would have cracked up at harder than anyone. And there was just this wonderful release. And that moment where you have tears streaming down your face and your belly laughing is sort of the greatest art there is in my mind. So that's what we aspire to do, is to hopefully have you laughing and crying. You can only handle so much drama, or it gets maudlin, and then for me, I don't want to just laugh. I want to, when I go to the movies, I love to also feel something. So that's, if that's the genre, that's the one I like.
Okay, but even your play, All New People, really sort of does that too, and starts off in that same kind of way. It's almost absurd in the way that the play starts.
Yeah.
Using that same kind of philosophy, just sort of saying, hey, pay attention right now.
I think you get, as a creator of stuff, I think you can get the audience in with humor. You're not going to get them in my humble opinion, it's easier to get them in and get everyone liking these characters with humor, because that's how we get to like people. You get to know them and like them and root for them with humor, even if we see they're flawed, you know, a flawed protagonist that you're going, oh, what an idiot, but you're still laughing at or with him, getting to know them. And then once the audience is rooting for them, even if they're flawed, then it really affects the audience when someone does something to them or something happens to them. In fact, here's an interesting example. We have a scene where Kate Hudson's character is being sexually harassed at work by a real jerk. And I initially wrote it that it would be funny because, I mean, obviously she's being sexually harassed and it was inappropriate and the guy needed to be fired. But we thought we could have our cake and eat it too by having what he was saying be so outrageous that the audience couldn't help but chuckle. And then be so happy when he got fired because he's a jerk. And on set, everyone was chuckling. Kate, the women, men, everyone. It was just so absurd and it was funny. In the context of the film, the audience had already fallen in love with Kate and there was barely any chuckles. They abhorred this guy so much because he was effing with someone that they now cared about. And it was so interesting and wonderful because I don't care about the chuckles on that. Who needs it? It proved so early that in introducing Kate in the way we had, that they already loved her and were rooting for her and didn't want anyone messing with her. Love that.
Yeah, but it's also this thing too, and you even do it in the play, where what seems like these vignettes actually knit into a whole. And I wonder if that's something that is a conscious thing for you, that you sort of say, I want these things to feel like it's episodic, but in fact, it's all moving us towards this conclusion. Is that something you do consciously, or is this just something that's happened as you've been working?
That is funny. That is a sort of a theme. I mean, even with Scrubs and the fantasies, obviously I wasn't a writer on Scrubs, but I guess it's just what I like. In the play, I did something that I hadn't really seen before, and that was cut away to pre-filmed segments that were sort of flashbacks. You know, I guess I'm just trying to do something and break the rules a little bit. I mean, I was told by everyone, like, oh, you can't, no one's going to do that. And then second stage, Carol Rothman loved it, and she said, let's do it. So I don't know. I thought it's interesting to, you know, again, this film has these fantasy sequences. I hadn't really ever seen those in a totally realistically played family movie. And I thought, well, that would be interesting. What would it be like to see the adult manifestation of his childhood heroic fantasy self serve as sort of like a Greek chorus, a guiding force in his life now in a metaphoric way? And I hadn't really seen something like that before, and I thought it would be interesting.
Because I guess what you must feel a little bit is that you must chafe a little bit at these sort of arbitrary boundaries that are set in terms of you can't do this and you can't do that.
I find it so silly. I mean, some of it you just have to. It's so interesting now. So one of the rules is that you, quote unquote, enter the new world on page 30. And if you're hearing this for the first time, next time you go to a movie, any movie, check your watch when the new chapter starts, the second chapter. That is to say, the first 30 minutes are setting up the status quo. The world, whatever world you're watching, this is the way the world is. At 30 minutes like that, you enter the new world. Things have always been this way, and at 30 minutes exactly, you go to the new chapter, the way things are now going to change. That's a rule. And what's interesting is about it is if you try and fight that rule, audiences are so conditioned to it now that they might not even know it. But if you're 15 minutes late on that, you'll start to get antsy. Like what they don't know it. Well, they don't necessarily know why, but because every movie they've watched in the last however many years has had the new chapter of what's going to happen start 30 minutes in, they're like, hey, in their minds, what's going on? Why does this feel like it's lagging? Isn't that interesting? So there's some you kind of have to follow in some ways, and there's some you can break. They're very, very hard to get made. That's why everyone passed on Garden State, where the third act should go. All of a sudden, they go on this quest for a piece of jewelry that hasn't been mentioned ever before.
Or the first act of Wish I Was Here goes on for a pretty long, you don't really state what the movie's about for a very long time.
Right, right. Well, when you have Final Cut, you can make some bold choices.
Well, see, and that's why people listen to the show, so they can learn these lessons. Zach, thanks so much for doing
this. Thank you so much for having me. I really love the show, and I was honored you asked me.
Oh, my pleasure. My guest is Zach Braff, Rule Breaker. His new film is writer, director, and star is Wish I Was Here. He's also starring in Bullets Over Broadway, the musical. Our recording engineer at Argo Studios is Paul Ruess. The show is mixed by Melissa Morton. It's edited and produced by Jenny Radelet. I'm not quite a man yet. I'm Elvis Mitchell. It's The Treatment.
Find past episodes of The Treatment at kcrw.com or subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. Listen to The Treatment on demand on your smartphone with KCRW's apps. The Treatment is produced and distributed by KCRW Santa Monica.